Welcome to All Africa Silencing the Guns series, where we focus on peace building on the continent. I'm Juanita Williams for All Africa, and we're talking about the situation in Mozambique, where terror engulfs the northern province of Cabo Delgado. Today we'll hear from David Matsinye, Southern African researcher at Amnesty International, and author, historian, and peace practitioner Yusuf Adam, who shares his experiences after a field visit in the north. But let's first recap what led Cabo Delgado to become the center of battles between government troops and fighters led by men the US has now designated as Islamist terrorists. Amnesty International's David Matsinye breaks it down.
As you know, Mozambique became independent 45 years ago in 1975. And the province of Cabo Delgado back then, during the colonial era, it was a neglected space. And this was carried forward. It continued after independence. That means the people of Cabo Delgado have been neglected by the current government. There's been little investment in social services, such as education, construction of infrastructure such as roads and bridges so that people can live their lives and trade with each other. And there's been little investment in health services, water and sanitation distribution infrastructures. That means for all these years, people have relied on the land, the natural ecosystem around them, to provide for themselves, for their livelihoods, for food, for water, for housing, medicinal plants, for fishing, even for their own cultural identity, because the land isn't just a commodity. It is also a cultural element that bestows a sense of identity to people. So this is what has been happening in the past 45 years after independence. What happens is that about 10 years ago or so, the province of Cabo Delgado showed to have large reserves of natural resources, including gold, rubies, graphite, and there's also large reserves of natural gas. So it attracted not only the government to come to Cabo Delgado, so to speak, but also multinational corporations interested in exploiting these resources. So the multinational corporations and the government worked together to displace people, dislocate them from their land in order to make room for these business ventures. In fact, in a district called Montepuez, in one of my trips there, I spoke with local government authorities who were complaining that the entire district of Montepuez has been licensed to a mining company and other multinational corporations interested in mining rubies there, so much so that there's no more land left for people to live in, for people to grow food, for people to collect construction material. We are talking about housing, okay? So this is a serious problem, and the local authorities were complaining to us about it, saying there isn't much that we can do about it because the orders come from the central government to license these lands to multinational corporations. In fact, if you look at the land, at the map of Cabo Delgado, you will see that the entire province of Cabo Delgado, except the natural reserve there, has been licensed to mining companies for mining projects and mining prospections. Absolutely nothing for people to grow their food, to continue to maintain their livelihoods. Now, I've said at the beginning that there was no investment in education. lack of investment in education for the past 45 years meant that the people of Cabo Delgado, especially young people, were left without skills. There was no skills development, which means not only are they unemployed, but they are also unemployable in the growing mining and gas industry in the province. So they are standing aside and look outsiders, those who come from elsewhere, within and without the country, benefiting from the development of these mining and gas projects. Now, that creates huge discontent, especially among young people.
Unfortunately, David says, the violence is spreading to other regions.
And mind you, it's not only Cabo Delgado. All those provinces in northern Mozambique, including Niassa and Nampula, are facing the same issues. So the insurgents have been able to recruit young people, not only from within Cabo Delgado, but from Nampula and Niassa. And they've joined the ranks, and they are part of these insurgents, you know, that are creating problems in northern Mozambique. And if I could quickly add, there's been a tendency to emphasize, especially among international scholars and within the government of Mozambique, the tendency to emphasize the external element of this conflict, arguing that it's external, you know, forces from ISIS that are invading and violating Mozambique's sovereignty and creating problems for the country, Islamic insurgents. Well, Islamic insurgents actually are young people that have been recruited due to these local grievances from within these three provinces. Those are overwhelming majority that are part of the fighters that are creating problems in northern Cabo Delgado.
David Matsinye, Southern African researcher for Amnesty International, wants to know why the government is not allowing aid and human rights organizations and journalists free access to survivors of the attacks.
And if researchers and human rights monitors and journalists are not allowed, on what basis then is the Mozambican government making its decisions about Cabo Delgado?
Yeah.
On what basis is the government of Mozambique designing policies and implementing in Cabo Delgado so that peace and security can be restored in the country? So practically, the people of Cabo Delgado, in terms of information about them, are not visible, not only to the outside world, but also to the Mozambican government. What are they trying to keep under the rug? Now, our research has shown that there are serious allegations of human rights violations and war crimes and mass graves. Is this that the government is trying to hide from the international community? Because if you want to restore peace and security in the country, let the truth come out. Otherwise, there will be no reconciliation. Otherwise, we will continue to have a conflict. When people don't see their pain, their truth recognized and dealt with, then the resentment will continue. The tendency to pick up arms and fight for recognition will always be there. So, you know, this is what we are asking ourselves. Why are they preventing us from entering the area, conducting investigations, monitor human rights, document what's happening? You know, investigators and journalists, the media, to enter the province in order to allow people to speak directly to the international community, to speak directly to the country, and tell their own stories, tell their own trauma. And it's very important for us to be aware of what's happening in Cabo Delgado. Because when you deny the victims of this conflict their right to be known mm-hmm. by speaking, and the right of the public to know them, then you are actually killing them for the second time. Because death isn't only a physical death. Death is also not being known. Your story is not known. You can't reach out to others and speak who might be sympathetic to your plight and, you know, provide assistance. So the Mozambican government is denying this. And we believe that, you know, one of the ways in which an effective intervention could be put in place is to allow the people of Cabo Delgado to speak directly to the international community.
You are listening to All Africa's Silencing the Gun series on peace building on the continent. And if you've just joined us, David Matsinye from Amnesty International asked some pointed questions about the government's reluctance to give aid and human rights organizations and journalists free access to survivors of the attacks in the north of Mozambique.
What are they hiding? What are they trying to keep under the rug? Now, our research has shown that there are serious allegations of human rights violations and war crimes and mass graves. Is this that the government is trying to hide from the international community? Because if you want to restore peace and security in the country, let the truth come out. Otherwise, there will be no reconciliation. Otherwise, we will continue to have a conflict. When people don't see their pain, their truth recognized and dealt with, then the resentment will continue. The tendency to pick up arms and fight for recognition will always be there. So, you know, this is what we're asking ourselves. Why are they preventing us from entering the area, conducting investigations, monitor human rights, document what's happening? What are they trying to hide? Those are the questions that we ask ourselves.
Thank you, David, for sharing your expertise with Silencing the Guns, All Africa's focus on peace building on the continent. Describe as one of the most respected long-term researchers of Cabo Delgado in Mozambique, retired Professor Yusuf Adam spoke with us from Maputo after seeing the horrific living conditions of Mozambicans displaced by the ongoing fighting. But before sharing those details, he tells us what his approach to peace building is.
I'm a researcher and I still do a lot of research on contemporary history of the world, Southern Africa and Mozambique. And I've been working for many, many years on Cabo Delgado and other places where there is a conflict and social transformation going on. That's my books are about the development of the development policies of Mozambique from 1974 up to today. And I also wrote about cooperatives and agricultural development in Mozambique. And then I have written quite extensively now about the war in Cabo Delgado and this conflict which is going on. But my interest is peace. I'm more a peace scholar than a conflict scholar. I'm working in Cabo Delgado, trying to see how one can stop this war as soon as we can, because it doesn't take us to any place.
Yeah, we've spoken with researchers about Cabo Delgado, especially we spoke after the Palma attack, and he was telling us about Palma and the history behind Palma and the reason that Cabo Delgado is in the situation that it is, that there's a history behind it in terms of people being ignored by the government, you know, people not getting services. What is your thinking around
Look,
that?
My idea about this war is that there are the underlying causes have to be searched in the political economy of the region and in the development policies of the Mozambican state. When this turmoil started in 1995, I have been working from 85 to 95 in the villages in the northern part of Cap Delgado. Then I did some basically working in wood concessions, working with peasants and their communities and communal organizations, which had the role of administering forests. It was called the community councils for the use of natural resources. And I was working with a colleague from the University of Bern and colleagues from the University Eduard Mondlane and others. And at that time, we verified that there was a profound crisis in the villages in the region because of exactly the families were not getting the resources they should have been getting from the state. 20% of the revenues which the operators paid to the government had to go back to the peasant families. It went to the communities, and the communities used the money without any clear strategy. We also didn't know very well who managed the money. The money was managed not in the village where we were and where it should be managed, but in another village. But there were, you couldn't see much use of these public funds. Okay, and when in 2017, when this attack in the district of Musim occurred, I said, the omelette is ready because the eggs were already there. And as you said, it has to do with the development policies. It also has to do with the way the gas and oil companies did their investments. They didn't pay what the peasants fisher folk, because these people on the coast have this their economy in two legs. So these people were not very happy with what the gas and especially Anadarko, ExxonMobil, etc., offered to pay them. There is a study done in the first years of this project where a sociologist was speaking to the peasants, and they showed their daily accounts, and they said, we make much more money with our agriculture and fishing than the money the petrol company is going to give us. So it means that there was no just payment to the people who were being taken out of these areas. And, you know, these areas also have a problem. You have a youth bulge. If you look at the demographics of the area, you'll see that the age pyramid has a youth bulge.
But you said you just come back from the field. And I mean, I'd like to get into sort of the practicalities of being a peace practitioner. We spend so much time talking about what the problem is and where the problem came from, but it would be really good if we could speak about, so what are some of the possible solutions? What's the possible pathway where we could find that area in a situation where there is peace or peace is being built in some way?
Yeah, I don't think this war has a military solution. Yes, if the Mashababs are using an armed component, so that means that we have to, the state has to reply using force. But the solution at this is some kind of negotiation with everyone, but based in communities and community institutions. You know, I'm speaking about the heads of the local leaders, the heads of the local chiefdoms. The PMUN as the women who are very important running this state, these small chiefdoms, because these PMUN are the ones who give power to the chief. When, you know, chief dies, a new one comes, is the PMUN who has this right and power to give, to make him a chief. So, and also working with mosques, with Christian, Catholic groups, Christian, other Christian denominations, working with everyone to create a dialogue. And I think that is something which is possible. But what is important at this moment is that this violence be stopped as soon as possible, because if we don't stop this violence, we'll continue to have this huge amount of IDPs. We have about 800,000 IDPs. We have about 2,000-3,000 people dead. Of the IDPs, we have about, I don't know, about 800,000 kids. There are a lot of women who have been abducted by the Mashababs, but there is also a lot of women who have been molested by any armed men in the conflict. So it is a very difficult situation. And I now with the South African battalion, the SADCC group, the Rwandans, etc., it is going to be more tense and more difficult. The Portuguese army is going to train Mozambican soldiers, but I don't think that will be. Yeah, that will be important, because the Mozambican army has been disinvested. Do you say that in English?
Mozambican army has been disinvested. In what context would that be?
From when the war with RENAMO ended, in the agreement there was written that Mozambican army couldn't have more than 30,000 men. But these 30,000 men target was never filled. Then there was no investment in equipment, in resources, etc. Okay, there was a lot of promises, but they were not fulfilled. So you have an army which lacks in equipment, training, logistics, etc.
That seems like a perfect storm of conditions to create something that's going to be really challenging to bring to an end. I mean, as you said earlier, was in the mid-90s when the situation started. It's been left to fester for quite a while.
Yeah, the thing is that, you know, one way or another, the situation was there, and the people who revolted, they are mainly from the region. They are not people who probably they could have some international liaisons. The U.S. and the others are trying to brand them as some kind of IS-affiliated organization, but in the field we haven't seen it. Now, what is very clear is that they have a people's popular support. But in the end, who suffers is the people, because they have to run from one side to another. And the IDPs, the situation of the IDPs is terrible. If you go to a town like the provincial capital, like Pemba, and you visit, they have a emergency transit camp in a sport pavilion. You know, visiting that is like going to the. It's like going into a, how do you say it in English? The Shida aos Infernos. It's going down into.
I see what you mean. The hell.
No, you're going down in not to paradise. What is the opposite of paradise? Hell.
Yes, hell, you know, hell. Dante's Inferno is what you were referring to.
It is. If you go into that, you understand what is Dante's Inferno. You know, you find babies with 2 years old or 3 years old with a shot. There a man, an old man with a shot in his leg. He should be in hospital. You know, they get some food. But there is no proper conditions, and the state has no capacity to give aid. And generally, there is an over. Most of the people I interviewed, they said, you know, international NGOs, bona fide organizations like Médecins Sans Frontières, etc., various others. They are not allowed to intervene in certain areas, speak to people, etc., because there is some kind of the government officials look at it in as some interference in the internal affairs of the country. Then most of the, for example, if you want to help the IDPs who come from Palma, etc., is a terror history because story, because when they arrive in Pemba, they are not first taken care by Red Cross, international organizations who have this role. They first are vetted by the police because they think that in the middle of this group, there are infiltrators. And, you know, when you have this theory of infiltration, you really, your communication with the people who are running from hell, in fact, in what happened in Palma, Simba, etc., is terrible. And what we need... A is to give aid not only to the IDPs, internally displaced people, but also to the people who live in the communities where they arrive. Because now you have a lot of people telling me, and sure, there was someone telling me, it is good to be an IDP because you get rice, you get food, you get support. And we don't get anything. Yeah, it was a bit the person who was speaking, one of them. I could say, but he has a, you know, he's a politician. He has agricultural production. I saw he had a crop in his yards ready to sesame seed crop, which was very good, and etc. But he was complaining about that the IDPs were getting more attention and more resources than the local communities. So means that the agencies, the international community, has to look at the population of Cap Delgado as a whole. And I think that the ones who are there have the same difficulties as the people they receive. The other idea which has to be challenge is the idea that, you know, it's all brotherly, come to my house, I will help you. There are families which have 30, 40 people which came from different districts living with them in Pemba. But the relationships in these families and between those who receive and those who come sometimes is very difficult, because they are used as cheap labor. There is a lot of sexual exploitation. I saw in some places someone had given he had about 1 hectare, 2 hectares of land, whatever, that received the people coming from Kisanga. And we could see in the face of the girls that they were traumatized, and someone showed me a small hut. The owner of the land has put that hut there for the girl he chose as his preferred. So he comes regularly to pay her a visit. And in other areas, for example, in the district of Makufi, I saw that in the places where the IDPs had to be, it's very near Pemba, had to be installed. They left, and the locals would say, but you know, they don't, they like to live in near the sea. It was near the sea. They don't like to do agriculture, etc., which is not true. What is the main problem in this community where I should have found 100 to 200 IDPs, I only found 3 people with whom I spoke, and they told me, we're working here in the, it is a very good farming area. In Cap Delgado, this black land, which is always humid, it's called, here in the south, we called it Mashongo. There in the north, at least in Chimaconde, it is called Uiva. This land is a very fertile land, so the owners are not going to give you access to the land if they don't get any benefit. And there are definite rules, like in that type of land, if you plant something, you have to divide it with the owner of the land.
Mm-hmm.
You can't plant perennial trees, you can't plant bananas, etc. So there is some of this, the people who are who had to leave their land are in a serious trouble. Now it seems that the government policies, or at least the discourse, has changed. Before, they used to say that they were going to build permanent villages, like towns, for them to stay. But the people want to go back to their original places. And now it seems to be acceptable in the official discourse that, you know, as soon as your areas from where you came from are stabilized in military terms, security is guaranteed, you can go back home.
So you were saying that you spent 20 days. Is that right? 20 days in different areas?
I was doing research with colleagues from ISS Pretoria and colleagues from the Center for Juridical and Judicial Studies here in Maputo. and also with some colleagues from ASIPOL, which is the police academy. And the idea was to understand the situation, to find out what are the ways to achieve peace, and understand what is going on. So that was also a training exercise for us, because generally there are problems when, for example, when you speak with the army about the war, they say, "Ah, we captured the terrorists, we send them to the courts, and the courts just liberate them." Then we, when we are in combat, we kill some of them, and they have the document which says that they have been considered not guilty in the court. Well, I think this is a bit of a myth, because no one has given us a document showing that, you know, some of these people went back to fight. Yeah. So it is, there is a very difficult situation in terms of human rights, and also the soldiers who are part of the Mozambican army at this moment, they have difficulties with food, with logistics, etc. And we have a problem because there are about 1,200 men working for Total, the Mozambican army, and they have far more better conditions in terms of logistics, foods, etc., than the other normal Mozambican soldiers in any other place in the province. And we all know that when the soldiers have difficulties in getting food and getting conditions, just steal. And from who they steal? From the population. So, you know, this saying that an army marches in it is in its belly, it's quite correct. But yeah, there are other problems. So today, with the arrival of all these forces, it's let's see how it's going to go. Because they don't speak the local language. Probably the ones from Rwanda speak Swahili. They could communicate, I'm not sure. But also the Rwandese are the ones who have acted as mercenaries in the Congo. And
So that danger that it would escalate the situation is there, the possibility.
Yeah, it is there, and I don't think it's going to be solved by military means. It means that everyone, you know, I like to compare all this when people discuss wars. I like to compare it to a war which no one speaks very much these days, is the Vietnam War. You saw what happened with the war in Vietnam. The same thing happens now with the war in this war in with the Taliban in the Middle East. It's quite complicated. After 20 years, the U.S. is leaving, and it's the problem is not solved.
Yeah, and I think that also the outside influences that people speak of. I think in South Africa, with the recent unrest, there has been talk of a third force, you know, and outside people wanting to create chaos. I think a lot of people have referenced the fact that Cabo Delgado itself is rich in natural resources. And even though it doesn't have infrastructure, then that might be behind some of the violence and the conflict.
Look, I think that yes, you can say that there is a problem with the natural resources, but the problem is more with the respect of the rights of the people who live there. They lost their land. They were not paid sufficient amount of money for what they lost. You're speaking about fisher and folk and agriculturalists. They do the two things. Generally, in these villages, they say, when it rains, we are happy people. We live in the paradise because we have good production in the farm and we have good production in the sea, because generally the fishing peak is in the period of the rains, December, November, from 20th December up to 1st of May. And these families, at this moment, some of them can't go fishing because the traditional areas of fishing has been cut off by the petrol companies. They're going to give them boats. They're going to train them to use boats and go farther in the sea to fish. But that is something which is more a promise than a reality.
Mm. So David was of the same mind as you, with Amnesty. He also said that the military solution is not, you know, he said he believes violence begets violence, and so it'll be a cycle. Some of the fighters have the support of the people in that community. I don't know if that's not a very simple question, but
No, the question is that the Mashabab Ujad, they started as a rebellion. I would even call them a people's rebellion. They've been organizing themselves because they saw that their rights were not respected. They wanted to be part of the division of the resources, gas and oil, minerals, etc. And fine, they use Islam as a cover-up for their ideology. But basically what they want is they want that the resources which exist in their areas are benefit them, okay? Mm. Then you have all these discourses of anti-Islamism or the Islamic terror, etc. But look at what happened in Afghanistan. After all these years, the U.S. left 20 years. Where we are in the same position we were before. And there were Mozambicans who left Mozambique to fight in Afghanistan. They were part of the U.S. supported groups which fought the Soviets. Probably some of them also went to Somalia and other places where they joined these extreme violent groups. And there are conditions. Cabo Delgado has natural conditions for this type of life. And that has to take it off. We need to work with, we have to create conditions for the people to live in peace. And the only thing at this moment matters is peace, is not war. And that has to be done. Creating conditions for people to produce. The international multinationals have to take care in a way that they are just with the population. But that hasn't been the track record of oil and gas companies is not so good.
You've been listening to Silencing the Guns, all Africa's focus on peace building on the continent. Today we were discussing the ongoing conflict in northern Mozambique. At the time of my discussion with historian Yusuf Adam, the Rwandan troops had not yet arrived in Mozambique. Since their landing in the north in mid-August, civil society observer group Cabo Ligado is attributing the success of the Rwandan troops in early battles to their capacity to fight in ambushes. The Rwandans are also being seen favorably by civilians, says Cabo Ligado. Joseph Hanlon reports that it appears the Rwandans will create a security zone to protect the interests of the French oil company Total, which was earlier forced by insurgents to pull back from its project to exploit gas reserves. The insurgency has damaged the prospects of developing gas fields off the Mozambican coast, which have the potential to turn around the country's economy.
The latest report from Rwanda's The New Times says the joint task force of Rwandan and Mozambican forces have surrounded the insurgents' last major areas of operation. To follow developments in Mozambique, go to allafrica.com/Mozambique. Thank you once again to historian, author, and peace scholar Yusuf Adam and David Matsinye, Southern African researcher for Amnesty International, for sharing their expertise with us. And thanks to the mother of community radio in Africa, Bush Radio 89.5 FM, for the partnership. All Africa is grateful to the Carnegie Corporation of New York for supporting our reporting on peace building in Africa.